This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, welcome to PM. I'm Linda Mottram. Tonight, first results from the ABC's Australia Talks survey, and drug and alcohol abuse are among the nation's top concerns. We'll meet a woman who says she was a high-functioning addict until it all spun out of control.
I got arrested in March of 2017, and now I've got criminal convictions. I've been to prison, and I wish I had made a better decision back then, but this is my life now.
What else matters most to you? We'll find out. And an American basketball team hastily retreats from a social media post supporting Hong Kong protesters. All it took was some outrage from China. That's ahead on PM. But first tonight, the scene is set for Turkey to invade northeastern Syria, fueling fears of a bloodbath against Kurdish forces there after the White House announced that US troops will, quote, no longer be in the immediate area. The Kurds have been key to dealing with thousands of ISIS fighters and their families pushed into the northeastern part of Syria as the remnants of the long civil war have played out. They've done that with US support, but Turkey's President Recep Tayyip Erdogan sees things differently, and now Donald Trump is getting out of his way. Let's get more from our Middle East correspondent Adam Harvey. Adam, what has the White House announced and why now?
Well, in an unexpected 11 p.m. Press release, the White House has said that Turkey will be moving forward with its operation into northern Syria, that US troops won't get in the way. It's basically a green light for a Turkish invasion of Kurdish-controlled Syria. Why now? Well, Recep Tayyip Erdogan has been pushing for this for a long time. There have been limited Turkish actions into northern Syria a couple of times. This is appears to be laying the groundwork for a fully-fledged invasion of that Kurdish-controlled area in the northeast of the country. It's an extraordinary development. We don't really know what's going to happen, whether we'll see Turkish troops inside some of those Kurdish border cities or just troops coming across the border and taking up positions in a kind of a buffer zone. The Kurds have already said that they'll, if there is a Turkish invasion, that they will fight back, hence the predictions of a bloodbath.
And so why do the Kurds fear this decision? What's the backstory here?
Well, Recep Tayyip Erdogan has been promising to do something like this for a long time. He considers the Kurds as terrorists. He considers the SDF, the self-defense forces in northeast Syria, as part of the KPK, the Kurdish separatists who are fighting inside Turkey. The Kurds fear what's going to happen because you've got an invading army coming across the border. There will be a conflict. There'll be, undoubtedly casualties. And one of the things that the White House has said in its statement is that Turkey will now be in charge of the ISIS prisoners who have been captured over the last couple of years in northern Syria. So there's about 2,000 fighters who have been detained inside Kurdish prisons, and as we know, about 70,000 ISIS family members who are being held in a refugee camp a bit further south. So one of the other concerns is that all of these fighters and families will be freed. The Kurds have already said that ISIS cells will get into Al-Hol camp and release their family members. And, of course, Turkey is allowed a lot of the ISIS fighters to come into northern Syria in the first place. There's no guarantee that the ISIS fighters who are being held in prisons won't just be released.
And so you say it's a little unpredictable, but Recep Tayyip Erdogan has been quite forthright in his language about this, hasn't he? I mean, is the word bloodbath, which some in Kurdish circles are using, is that likely to be what we see? Or will Erdogan be required to contain it a little bit more because of the need to try and control the ISIS element?
Well, it depends, I suppose, on the reaction from the Kurds. If the SDF pull back from the border and basically allow the Turks to come in, no, there won't be a bloodbath. But if there is a fully fledged conflict, there will be. The Turkish military is extremely powerful. They have hundreds of fighter jets, thousands of tanks. The SDF have no armour at all. It'll be an extremely one-sided battle.
Thanks very much for your time. Adam Harvey is our Middle East correspondent on those developments breaking in northern Syria. Well, as the Trump administration manoeuvres in Syria, impeachment developments march on in Washington. The White House is dismissive of news that a second whistleblower has come forward in the Ukraine scandal that's prompted the Democrats' impeachment inquiry. But while the White House was saying nothing to see here, one of the Republican Party's most respected elders was calling out Republican members of Congress for caring more about their jobs than upholding the Constitution. Louise Creeley has the details.
The Republican Party has got to get a grip on itself right now.
Colin Powell has some strong words for those in his party.
Republican leaders and members of the Congress, both Senate and the House, are holding back because they're terrified of what will happen to any one of them if they speak out.
The former US Secretary of State criticised American foreign policy as a shambles and says those in Congress need to speak out if something isn't right.
A couple of weeks ago, the president put a circle around Southeast Alabama saying it's going to get hit by a hurricane. And in my time, in her time, one of us would have gone to the president and said, Mr. President, you screwed up. So we've got to fix it. And we'll put out a correction. You know what they did this time? They ordered the Commerce Department to go out and back up whatever the president missaid. This is not the way the country's supposed to run.
Sparks flew too in a heated exchange between Meet the Press host Chuck Todd and Republican Senator Ron Johnson, who was accused by Todd of skirting questions over the president's dealing with Ukraine.
Chuck, I just want the truth. The American people want
so
the truth.
So do you not trust the FBI? You don't trust the CIA?
No,
I'm just very confused here.
Donald Trump reacted to the interview via a tweet, saying sleepy eyes Chuck Todd had a total meltdown. Seems that a not very bright Chuck just wasn't getting the answers he was looking for in order to make me look as bad as possible. I did nothing wrong. A whistleblower complaint about Donald Trump's dealings with Ukraine led to the current investigation into the president and possible impeachment. Now lawyers representing the first whistleblower say they're working with another source who's put forward a separate complaint about the president's phone call with Ukraine. In response to the news, the White House Press Secretary Stephanie Grisham released this statement.
It doesn't matter how many people decide to call themselves whistleblowers about the same telephone call, a call the president already made public, it doesn't change the fact that he's done nothing wrong.
Despite the controversy, late last week, President Trump called on other countries to investigate Joe Biden, who's likely to be his main rival in the 2020 election.
By the way, likewise, China should start an investigation into the Bidens, because what happened in China is just about as bad as what happened with Ukraine.
Democratic Senator Chris Murphy says he's deeply scared that Republicans have chosen to stand by the president.
That interview was just a giant green light to the president of the United States to continue to solicit foreign interference in U.S. elections. He telegraphed that he's going to ask China to do the same thing that he asked the Ukrainians to do this week, because Republicans are allowing him to do it. And this entire country should be scared that at a moment when we need patriots, what we are getting is blind partisan loyalty.
In the past few hours and under pressure, President Trump lashed out at the top Democrat in Congress on Twitter. He said House Speaker Nancy Pelosi could be guilty of treason.
Louise Creeley with that report. You're listening to PM on the radio, on the ABC Listen app and via the podcast. I'm Linda Mottram. On Twitter, I'm at Linda Mottram. Ahead, why is Iran detaining so many foreigners and dual nationals? Professor Abbas Milani, who was himself a political prisoner, shares his view.
This is a pattern, unfortunately, that this regime has engaged in. And it is, to me, just tragic to see these lives destroyed because they seem to be in the wrong place at the wrong time.
After a big conversation across the country, the ABC has found that 90% of Australians we spoke to see drug and alcohol abuse as one of the biggest issues for the nation. There are lots of other findings too from a new ABC project called Australia Talks, which is about finding out what is important to us as a nation. More than 54,000 people across the country have been taking part, and over the next 6 weeks we will dig into the answers across the ABC. Our reporter Alison Horne has the first findings, but I asked her first to explain why the ABC is doing this project.
Linda, the aim of this is to kind of get Australia having an open conversation about the issues that are important to us as a nation so we can essentially understand each other better. Now, as you mentioned, we've surveyed more than 54,000 people, asking them nearly 500 questions on everything from health, education, money, the environment, through to national identity, culture and religion. Now, this project was done in conjunction with Vox Pops Labs, and it's been done with participants across the country, so not just ABC audiences. And from that data, it's been weighted on the basis of markers like sex, age and geographic location to really provide a nationally representative sample of the Australian population. And as you mentioned, over the next 6 weeks, we're going to be examining all of those results across the ABC to really dig into those issues that are important to us as a nation. And it's not just a one-way street. If people are wondering how their views compare to the rest of the country, this is a conversation we want them to be part of. On the ABC website, people will be able to answer their own small selection of those survey questions and then receive a personalised snapshot of the results to see where they fit in Australia.
So there's obviously going to be a lot revealed, unveiled as these stories come out. But what are some of the major findings you can share with us today?
Well, from the outset, it seems that the majority of people, that is 70%, think Australia is the best place in the world in which to live, which is kind of obvious. But the thing is, if we look towards the future, the survey indicates that we do have some concerns. Now, 57% of people are dissatisfied with how things are going in Australia. If we look at individuals, Australians rate climate change, saving enough money for retirement, and health as the top three issues affecting them personally. And the issues rated as the biggest concerns for the nation as a whole are household debt, cost of living, and drug and alcohol abuse, with 90% of the population worried about that issue.
That's a really big number. What do the health statistics show about Australians' drug use?
Well, it's pretty concerning. Australia is now second only to the United States for ice consumption. And drug researchers believe a more national approach is needed to thwart the further spread of the drug and hope this idea of depenalisation could be one solution. Now, you're about to meet Talia Adams. She first tried the drug ice about 12 years ago. And from that first hit, she was hooked. Now, the 29-year-old describes herself as a high-functioning addict. She'd spend about $1,000 a week to feed her habit.
I was using for 10 years and I used every day. No one in my daily life would have ever thought that I was using ice. I held down really good jobs and I finished my Bachelor of Business and I had a good home and I had a partner.
Talia Adams says she's proof ice addiction doesn't discriminate. Methamphetamine is the most used illicit stimulant in Australia, with an estimated 10,000 kilograms consumed last year. The massive spread of the drug has been fuelled by its relative availability and cheapness. One hit generally costs less than $50. And like so many other addicts, ice sent Talia's life spiralling out of control all the way to prison.
I got arrested in March of 2017 And now I've got criminal convictions. I've been to prison. And I wish I had made a better decision back then, but this is my life now.
In Talia's home state of Queensland, people caught with drugs automatically face criminal charges. Police can't divert them to other facilities such as rehabilitation or education programs. The practice known as depenalisation is in place in all jurisdictions except the Sunshine State and New South Wales. Drug researcher Dr. Caitlin Hughes from Flinders University says there's clear evidence diversionary tactics reduce reoffending and improve social outcomes for users.
The provision of the criminal conviction for someone who is using or possessing drugs alone will often lead to far more damaging consequences.
Senior police in Queensland and New South Wales have lobbied lawmakers to adopt a national approach to curb the ICE epidemic, and both state governments are considering depenalisation. Dr. Caitlin Hughes again.
We've got this very big difference in our state and territory responses at the present, and when you speak to police as well as health practitioners across Australia, there is a strong desire to expand the provision of alternatives to arrest.
Talia Adams believes that approach could have changed her life dramatically.
I didn't have a criminal history before 2017. So when I was charged, I just went, oh, well, my life's over. I was really destructive. So I kicked it up a notch, I guess you could say. I got so many more charges after that. If someone had stopped me at that first point of contact, I wouldn't have nearly as many charges. I wouldn't have gone to prison. My life wouldn't be the way that it is now, for sure.
She's now been out of jail for 3 months and is no longer using, but her criminal conviction is making it hard to get a job or buy a car and move on with her life.
I definitely think that drug addiction is a health problem and not a criminal problem.
Recovering drug addict Talia Adams, Alison Horne reporting that story. And you can check out more about how your attitudes and experiences compare to those of other Australians. Visit abc.net.au/AustraliaTalks. Australia's top civil aviation administrator is being accused of introducing overzealous maintenance standards in the wake of a fatal crash in South Australia in 2017. The Civil Aviation Safety Authority is now in a standoff with a federal senator who's demanding the changes be withdrawn, and if they aren't, he'll force them to be dropped. Here's political reporter Tom Eagledon.
A parliamentary inquiry has been looking into how air safety investigators have handled a crash in Mount Gambier in 2017 that killed three people, and it hasn't liked what it's seen. Centre Alliance Senator Rex Patrick.
CASA has a tendency to over-regulate. In my view, if CASA were looking after road safety, no one would be allowed to drive.
The Civil Aviation Safety Authority is moving to enforce stricter maintenance standards on community aviation organisations after the Angel Flight crash. Problem is, maintenance doesn't seem to have been a factor in the crash. Even news reports on the day suggested thick fog was the main factor.
It was foggy and cold and wet.
The local airport website showing commercial flight delays in the time leading up to the accident.
The Air Transport Safety Bureau spent months looking into the crash, and it agreed fog was mainly to blame. CASA says in a statement that that report was the subject of the parliamentary inquiry, not its performance.
CASA only received the report late on Friday evening, immediately before a long weekend. We will need to take some time to review the report and consider the recommendations. We are, however, somewhat perplexed that a Senate inquiry into the performance of the ATSB somehow results in two recommendations for a completely separate organisation, CASA.
But Senator Patrick says a properly working air transport system is the aim of the game.
CASA did appear at the inquiry, and CASA are the only ones that have any changes before the Parliament, and so it's quite natural that recommendations were made in relation to CASA.
Senator Patrick's asked CASA to withdraw its proposed maintenance safety standards and says he has the numbers in Parliament to make it comply if necessary.
I'd be surprised if my disallowance doesn't get support in the Senate now, because the committee that handed down the report was a government-controlled committee, and indeed the findings of the committee were bipartisan.
78-year-old pilot Grant Gilbert died in the crash. He picked up mother and daughter Emily and Tracy Redding from Mount Gambier, planning to fly them to Adelaide for 16-year-old Tracy to get medical treatment. But the plane nosedived into a paddock just 3 kilometres from the airstrip. The mother and daughter were killed too. The flight was arranged by Angel Flight, a charity that helps rural communities access city hospitals. Its safety manager, Chris Owens, says he's glad someone's fighting the CASA changes.
We welcome the recommendations that CASA change their new regulations. And the two things that they have to change are two issues that were causing us some concern.
But CASA isn't the only federal agency coming in for criticism. The Air Transport Safety Bureau, whose report was the focus of the parliamentary inquiry, is also copping criticism over its handling of the fallout from the crash.
We're certainly concerned that they haven't been required to withdraw the report and redo the analysis. That leaves a stain on Angel Flight's reputation and a stain that we really don't deserve.
Senator Patrick.
It was found that they erred in relation to the statistics that they used and also in relation to how they investigated perceived pressure on pilots. For example, they found that there was perceived pressure, yet they didn't interview any pilots in relation to the investigation.
Centre Alliance Senator Rex Patrick, Tom Eagledon, our reporter. The weekend saw the release from an Australian prison of Iranian scientist Reza Debashi Kivi after more than a year in jail, coinciding with Iran's release of two Australian travel bloggers after they were imprisoned for more than 3 months in Iran. Another Australian academic, Kylie Moore Gilbert, remains in prison in Iran. Dual national academics appear to be at particular risk there, with another Australian, a population expert unheard of since her detention in Iran in December last year, still out of contact. Victoria Pengilly reports.
Australia is allowing Iranian scientist Reza Debashi Kivi to go home. He spent 13 months detained here over allegations he exported American radar equipment to Iran. Word of his release came just as two Australian travel bloggers, Jolie King and Mark Firkin, returned home after being jailed in Iran for more than 3 months for flying a drone. There's no confirmation from the Australian government that a prisoner swap took place. Mr. Debashi Kivi's lawyer is Poyang Afshar. He told RM Breakfast there may be a connection.
I cannot say whether one was connected to the other directly, but there's obviously been discussions between the two countries. I know that Maurice Payne had said on a number of occasions that she had spoken to Javad Zarif, who's the Iranian foreign minister, in relation to the two Australians.
Another Australian academic, Kylie Moore Gilbert, still remains jailed in Iran, where she has reportedly been sentenced to 10 years. But she's not the only one. Last December, an academic from the University of Melbourne was detained in Iran after being accused of social espionage and collaborating with the West. Mehmet Hosseini Shavoshi, an Australian-Iranian dual national, is a population expert who was on a study tour before her jailing. Her case is reported to have been dropped, but she hasn't been heard of since. Professor Abbas Milani is an Iranian-American political historian at the University of Stanford. He says it's not the first time an academic has been arrested in Iran, and both Australians join an ever-growing list.
Right now, as we speak, there's a French national that has been held. There are several American, Iranian academics who are being held. This is a pattern, unfortunately, that this regime has engaged in. And it is tragic to see these lives destroyed because they seem to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. These are lives that are probably destroyed forever.
Now, Dr. Shavoshi, the demographer, she studied Iran's population and fertility. Why would that be of concern to Iran? And would it actually be of concern? Or, as you said, is she merely just being used as a political pawn?
Ms. Shavashi has written a brilliant book called The Fertility Transition in Iran. There is nothing in any of what she has written, and I've read her book, that is in any way political. Again, my sense is she was at the wrong place at the wrong time and could be used as a tool.
Last year, conservationists and scholars around the world sent an open letter to Iran's supreme leader, advocating for the cases of 10 academics, many of who were studying the endangered Asiatic cheetah. One of the signatories was Professor Robert Harcourt, a conservationist from Macquarie University in Sydney.
When you start locking up people to stop them from performing actions which are for the greater good, you do risk putting people off from going into those sorts of areas in the future. And the long-term ramifications of that are really quite scary because it means that people are less and less honest about what we need to know about our natural world.
In a statement, the University of Melbourne said reports of the detention of international academics in Iran is of deep concern to our entire community. Professor Abbas believes Ms. Hosseini Shavoshi's detention is part of a wider crackdown on dual nationals, an attempt to minimise contact between Iran and the outside world. And he thinks part of the frequency of detentions has a lot to do with the handling of cases by foreign governments.
The reason they keep doing it is because Western countries have historically played ball with them. If they had been firm from the beginning and said no, then the game would not have been as profitable to them as it has been.
Professor Abbas Milani from Stanford University, our reporter Victoria Pengilly. And in a statement, the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade says it's providing consular assistance to an Australian in Iran and her family in Australia. They say privacy obligations prevent them from giving further information. Well, China's acute sensitivity over Hong Kong has been on display after the general manager of the Houston Rockets US basketball team tweeted, "Fight for freedom, stand with Hong Kong." The Chinese Basketball Association responded that it will sever all ties with the team, while big-name advertisers also deserted, prompting the general manager, Daryl Morey, to tweet an apology for causing offence. But there is support tonight for the stance backing the protesters from Australian basketball legend Andrew Gaze. David Taylor reports.
New York has gone 3.5 minutes without scoring. Yao Ming with a block.
Former American basketball player Yao Ming towered over his defenders as star player for the Houston Rockets.
Yao Ming down the lane.
The Hall of Famer now heads up the Chinese Basketball Association, or CBA. So when a social media post gave the impression his former team supports Hong Kong protesters, his reaction was swift. Here's a news announcement from the China Global Television Network shortly after the tweet went viral.
Daryl Morey tweeted out an image reading, "Fight for freedom, stand with Hong Kong" on Friday. The CBA responded by suspending any collaboration with the NBA team. The association is currently led by former Houston Rockets star Yao Ming.
The CBA's reaction underscores Beijing's extreme sensitivity about foreign attitudes towards the ongoing protests. In damage control, Rockets general manager Daryl Morey deleted the retweet and said in a statement, quote, "I did not intend my tweet to cause any offence to Rockets fans and friends of mine in China. I was merely voicing one thought based on one interpretation of one complicated event." Andrew Gaze represented Australia in basketball at the Sydney Olympics as the team captain. He says Mr. Morey shouldn't have had to apologise.
Now, that's disappointing because I think the view that was expressed is not unreasonable. We're all allowed to have opinions on politics and political regimes, and provided expressed in a respectful and appropriate way, I don't think what was said was necessarily disrespectful. It's just standing by a cause and a group of people that have a different view than what the current regime has.
Innocuous or not, the bloodletting continues. Chinese state broadcaster CCTV says it's no longer airing Rockets games. Tencent Holdings, which streams NBA games in China, also says it's suspending Rockets coverage. And sportswear brand Li Ning and the Shanghai Pudong Development Bank also announced on Sunday they would stop cooperation with the team. The NBA issued its own statement saying it recognised Morey's views have, quote, "offended so many of our friends and fans in China, which is regrettable." But it hasn't helped. Andrew Gay says the tweet and the reaction to it comes at a critical point for American basketball. So it'll hurt.
From a basketball standpoint, there's an understanding that basketball is an extremely popular sport in China. There's some fantastic relationships being built up with the club teams, with the federation. They've just recently hosted the World Cup. So they are a very big market with a lot of potential and are an emerging basketball nation.
Do you think Australian basketball authorities will at least take a message from this or learn a lesson from it?
I think that that message has already been there for quite some time. I think that this is a situation that, where someone has gone out and said something that perhaps, you know, was thinking from a very much a personal standpoint and trying to make a personal view, and perhaps clearly have made a mistake in their regard to how appropriate that would be and how potentially harmful it can be to the organisation.
Former Australian basketball captain Andrew Gaze speaking with David Taylor. I'm Linda Mottram. That is PM for today. You can always find us at the ABC Listen app and wherever you get your podcasts. That's where you should subscribe and leave us a review too. AM and The World Today are also there, so subscribe to them and leave them a review as well. Talk to you next time.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.
Hi, I'm Stephen Stockwell.
And I'm Ange Lavoie-Pierre, and we're from the ABC's daily news podcast, The Signal. It's starting to look like an outright cure for cancer is off the table for now. So if we can't make cancer disappear altogether, is it possible to live with it in a way that doesn't make us sick?
Cancer treatment is evolving quickly, and more people are surviving the disease. So why is a cure still so far out of reach? That's The Signal every weekday morning on the ABC Listen app or wherever else you find your podcasts.